It's Philosophy Talk.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions."
We produce so much food. We consume so much food. Why do so many people in the world go hungry?
They also sell fake food, which really knocks me out. Got rubber hot dogs, plastic fried eggs. The ones I saw are made in Austria. Imagine that, imported plastic fried eggs. Wow.
Is access to healthy food and clean water a basic human right?
Where's my food?
Our guest is global food security champion Tim Benton.
Calm down, have some dip.
Food justice.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken and I are in the philosophy department.
Today, we're talking about food justice.
Well, there's certainly a lot of food injustice in the world, Ken. 1 in 8 people are undernourished. Over 3 million children die every year from malnutrition. Whether you're a Kantian or a utilitarian or a Rawlsian, whatever your ethical philosophy is, that's just plain wrong.
And you know, John, it's just going to get worse. I mean, if we can't produce enough food to feed the 7 billion people on the planet now, what's going to happen in a few decades when the population hits 10 billion?
Well, oddly enough, it isn't the amount of food produced that's the problem, Ken. People go hungry because they can't afford the food that is available. It's such a shame, especially since so much food is wasted. Did you know that nearly one-third, or maybe more than one-third, of the food produced doesn't even make it onto the table?
Wow, that's astounding. So look, I got an idea. More people should just try growing their own food. I bet you that would make it cheaper, and I bet you that would cut down on all that waste, too.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, but it takes resources to grow your own food. And a lot of people who can't afford to buy food grown elsewhere also can't afford to grow food in their own backyards. Maybe they don't have backyards.
But I still think this should be, in principle at least, an easy problem to solve. You already said there's enough food to feed everyone. So we just need to figure out a better way to distribute the food, right? It's simple.
Well, yeah, it's simple to solve global warming, too, in principle. Just reduce our carbon emissions. Sounds easy. So why haven't we done that?
Well, let's not change the subject. We're talking about food, John.
Well, actually, the two subjects are pretty intertwined. Food insecurity and climate change go hand in hand. We probably won't solve either problem until we recognize their coexistence.
Well, I guess I see your point. Maybe you're talking about the environmental impact of transporting all that food. I guess I can see that if we had a more just distribution system, we'd have to move a lot more food around in a lot more places, a lot more carbon emissions.
Well, that's just the beginning. Think how many forests are cleared to raise livestock because of the consumer demand for meat, particularly meat from large animals. All those flatulent cows, Ken, have to be fed, which means that resources that could grow more reasonable food for people are used to grow food for livestock instead.
So you got a thing against meat. We should stop eating meat, right?
Well, it's not just meat. We have tastes for lots of foods that can only be grown in faraway places, whether it's tropical fruit or tea or coffee. And a lot of these places suffer from food and water insecurity. They use up valuable land growing stuff for us, and they don't grow stuff for themselves. So people in those areas can't get food, can't get water, and yet they manage to grow some coffee or quinoa for us.
It sounds like a depressing mess, John. So what do you think we do to fix it? I have to admit, I got to admit, I'm probably part of the problem. I love my morning coffee. I love a good steak, and I kind of resent. I have to admit, you're kind of guilt-tripping me into trying and making me want to give those up. And besides, I'm not convinced my giving this stuff up would do all that much.
Well, that's a traditional philosophical dilemma. One person seeing the right thing won't make a difference unless there's collective action. But you're an inspiring figure in the world, Ken. You cut down a little on your steak and drink some locally grown vile coffee, and I'm sure thousands would follow your example.
Yeah, but, you know, I got to admit, I got a weakness of will, and lots of people have weakness of will. We know in our heart of hearts what the right thing is to do, but we can't just bring ourselves to do it. You know, I just.
Yeah, we all suffer from what the Greeks called akrasia, which you might think is a fancy kind of cheese, but it's actually weakness of the will. That's why we drive cars, even though we know that carbon emissions contribute to climate change.
So look, that makes me think we can't really rely on individual actions or initiatives to change this thing. What we need is major structural change. I'm not saying that individuals don't have a role to play, but what we have to do is put political pressure on our governments and corporations to do the right thing. We've got to change the institutions, not just change the individuals.
I remember political pressure. That's what we used to deal with before all of our congressmen were bought and sold by large corporations, wasn't it? I think I made some notes about that somewhere. Actually, we need more than that. We need a major cultural shift in how we think about responsibility for food insecurity, Ken. People in rich nations think that helping poor people in far-off lands is somehow a matter of personal choice, out at the edges of their concerns, sort of like charity.
What's wrong with charity? Charity is a darn good thing.
Well, charity is fine, but it shouldn't be a matter of charity. It's a matter of acknowledging the access to healthy, nutritional food, of which there is plenty, is a basic human right, something that every person on this planet is entitled to.
Yeah, so you think it's kind of like our duty to do this, not just our choice. But, you know, that makes it a really tall order, John. I mean, it would involve everything from fighting for fair wages in West Africa to ensuring access to healthy foods in West Oakland.
And to help us see even more clearly how multifaceted the problem is, we sent our roving philosophical reporter Shuka Kalantari to explore the problems of food justice, and she files this report.
Hunger causes more health problems worldwide than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. But food justice isn't only about world hunger. It also has to do with what we eat. Our food choices can harm or help in the fight against food injustice. One way to help? Eat more chocolate. Fair trade chocolate, to be exact.
If you buy any old chocolate, you don't know what's going on in those supply chains.
That's Mary Jo Cook. She works at Fairtrade USA in Oakland, California.
Most cocoa farmers have never seen chocolate. They don't make enough money to send their kids to school or to have food security throughout the entire year.
By food security, she means having enough food to eat. Fairtrade starts with a group of farmers who agree to get certified.
That means they comply with rigorous standards around environmental sustainability, around workplace safety, around non-discrimination and gender equality, around sustainable farming practices.
In return, farmers get something called community development premiums, money for things like healthcare, food storage bins, or clean drinking water. Today, you can buy anything from Fairtrade sugar and coffee beans to Fairtrade bell peppers and bananas. On a recent trip to Haiti, Cook added mangoes to that list.
A quote that I will never forget when I met with some of these farmers was, "How many mangoes in a dozen?" And I said, "Well, 13. It's a baker's dozen." They said, "Always 13. I said, "Yeah, always 13. They said, "Because when the guy comes by with the truck, some days he'll say it's 20 mangoes to a dozen. Some days it's 25. Some days it's 18. It's whatever he wants to pay for that dozen."
The guy with the truck is now out of the picture, and the Haitian farmers can make a living wage. Today, Fairtrade USA works with 1.5 million farmers around the world, except in the United States. They said they're working on that. A couple of blocks away from Fairtrade's office, Oakland resident Ashelle Eldridge is doing something to fight food injustice locally. Ashelle says a lot of low-income neighborhoods are food deserts, places where it's easier to buy a Big Mac or a Big Gulp than it is to find a grocery store with fresh produce.
Food justice really is just the idea that people anywhere, regardless of who they are, regardless how much money they have or their race or class or gender or whatever, they have a right to have food. In a food just society, everyone would have access to healthy food.
That's why Ashelle created SOS Juice, a nonprofit that makes locally produced juice and educates kids about healthy food. Michelle decided the best way to get people interested in why things like Cheetos and Pepsi can lead to obesity and diabetes is through hip-hop. So he wrote this song.
Ain't nothing but a G thing. MSG, GMO, genocide of street gangs. Aspartame like street cane. Monsanto was Rambo, round up with ammo. Who would have known you can die from a diet? Diabetes and the itis from the dairy and the dose of the hot fructose. So you might start a riot, might be a fool fighter. That's what the streets them say. That's what my least them say. That's what that empire say. But death, diet, though, you can drop the same way.
What Ishelle Eldridge and Fairtrade USA have in common is that they both understand the power of the consumer to help fight food injustice. Sure, buying Fairtrade chocolate isn't going to end world hunger, and not buying junk food won't fix the obesity epidemic in America. But it sure can't hurt. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. Hip-hop to the rescue. Well, that's kind of reassuring, I guess. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about food justice. We're joined now by Tim Benton. He's the UK champion for global food security. He's also a professor of population ecology at the University of Leeds. That's his secret identity. Tim, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Tim, I know what a professor of population ecology is, but we've never had anyone on the show before whose title was champion. So tell me, what exactly does a champion for global food security do?
That's a very good question. I work 4 days a week helping the UK government and all of our public bodies with an interest in food to think about the challenges and find out about the challenges of food into the future. And if my title was a director of our global food security program, it would imply I could tell government what to do. But the term champion is nice and fuzzy and ambassadorial, and I can wave the flag about all of these issues without having any power at all.
All right, so it's a way for them to flatter you and get you to cajole them, but you can't command them.
That's exactly right. That's government for you.
Okay. So I assume there's a crown or a belt or a sash involved. I mean, sounds like a great title. So Tim, global food insecurity is doubtless a very complicated problem. But what would you say was kind of the biggest single factor we ought to focus on and think about?
I think without doubt, the single biggest factor is poverty. So lack of access, lack of affordability to food, and that applies just as much in the developing world with the 805 million who go to bed hungry each night as it does in the developed world where we have the poorest people who have access to shockingly bad food, which leads to lifelong ill health and early mortality. So, and poverty is the thing that combines those two things.
So, Tim, but that suggests to me, and maybe you don't mean to suggest this inference, but that suggests to me that if we could provide income support, say, for all the people around the world who lack the ability to pay for food, the problem would basically go away?
Is the idea that everybody in the world should be buying Omaha steaks through the internet? I mean, that can't be right.
Yeah, so, what do you think? I'm going to provide income support to all the poor people around the world.
The definition of food security, according to the UN bodies, is that you have access to enough safe, sufficient, nutritious food that meets your needs for a healthy life. And, you know, that is not true for a whole lot of people around the world. And there is an issue to do with income support. There is an issue to do with the infrastructure and the way food is moved around. There is an issue to do with power and why we have food deserts in our cities, as much as why can't people in the center of Africa, you know, get access to enough food? There are lots and lots of things here, and income support is one element of it, but not the totality.
So if poverty is a problem, does that mean that those of us that have plenty of money and are buying expensive wines and expensive foods aren't really a big part of the problem? We're just kind of an irritating footnote to the problem?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and there's a lot of debate around this. But I think for the developed world, most of us in Europe and North America, we waste just as a factoid, we waste about the same food, that is, we buy it and throw it away uneaten, as the whole of sub-Saharan Africa produces in a year. So if we chose to eat in a different way, it would free up an awful lot of agricultural resources that could provide food for people in other circumstances.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about food justice with Tim Benton from the University of Leeds.
Who's morally responsible for solving global food insecurity? Is it individual consumers, you and me, governments, the U.S., Britain, corporations, McDonald's, Monsanto, all of the above?
Food security, food justice, and moral responsibility, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed with a handful of Pringles, potato chips, and a ding-dong by my head. And at daytime, I'm Mr. Nasser, just the healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Junk food junkies. A lot of us, I suppose. The first world's version of food insecurity. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Ha ha ha, except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about food justice.
So we're not questioning your intelligence today, but we are questioning your diet. Our guest is Tim Benton from the University of Leeds. He is, believe it or not, the United Kingdom champion for global food security.
So Tim, I want to add, John said this isn't a matter of charity, it's a matter of rights and duties. That implies moral obligation, moral responsibility. So whose responsibility is it to solve the world's food problems? It's big ag, governments, or individuals like you and me? Whose responsibility is this?
Well, the right to food is recognized as a fundamental human right. So I think there is a moral obligation to all of us, in a sense, to ensure that people have access to food, and every bit that we can do to help that, I see it personally, this is why I do the job that I do, as something that's really important. And certainly, you know, we in the developed world have a history of not making things easier for the developing world. And so there's some moral obligation there, I think. We've created climate change largely through the developed world, and that's impacting on people's ability to grow food all around the world. So I think, you know, on an individual basis, we have that issue. And then, of course, all of our food, agriculture, we've all got bits to play, and of course our political class making those sorts of decisions about our rights.
But Tim, I wonder if I, as an individual consumer of the food choices presented to me by the global food economy or even the local food economy, should I feel some moral guilt for making the choices that I do? I mean, are my choices to buy that steak, is that a morally fraught choice that I should kind of reconsider or not? I mean, I didn't make this system. I didn't make the set of choices that are presented to me. So I'm wondering first what I, as an individual, my moral stake in this.
Your moral stake in steak. Yeah, exactly. Well, so just a bit of a fact. It takes about 10 to 12,000 litres of water to produce a kilogram of steak. You know, that's enough if you have a bath a day. That's enough for 4.5 months of baths.
Wow.
If you are eating steak and you're in a drought-rich country, which you presumably are where you're living, then there are some issues there, that there are moral issues to do with the way that your food is produced. If you drive a great big SUV and you produce a lot of carbon, then you're contributing to greenhouse gas and climate change and all of those other things. So there are issues to do with every person's consumption and the decisions that they make that impact on the environment and the social environment too.
So Ken, you need to shift from your moral steak to your moral eggplant, I think.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but the point you're making is, I think, a very powerful one. All those impacts, all those consequences, I look at that juicy steak on the shelf, right? And I think about barbecuing it, and I think about gathering my friends around. But that's all visible to me. But the consequences of that that consumption is highly invisible to me, unless you listen to shows like this or other shows. I mean, but for the most part, and the industry isn't trying to make those consequences visible to me. My government's not trying to make those consequences visible to me. It's kind of complicated, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the real issues and perhaps one of the forces for change as we are really starting to be in an information age. I mean, if you think about what consumers expect of food, are you going to a supermarket? You want high nutrition, you want good food safety, you want high welfare for the animals, you want sustainable food, you want cheap food, but you can't have it all. And the issue is that you aren't presented with the ability to choose the right sort of food with the sorts of attributes that allow you to make a sound moral choice.
So Tim, all these starving children and undernourished people, to what extent are those people who are living in places that in theory could sustain in normal years, with a little help in off years, drought years, and so forth, enough food for the people that live there? And if so, what are the major reasons they're not doing that?
On a global basis, we produce easily enough calories to feed 11 billion people. But we waste some, and we give 4 billion people's worth of calories to livestock to make meat, which is why meat is part of the issue, I think. So there, on a global basis, there's enough food to feed the world. And as you go down to ever smaller scales, whether it is within the US or within Europe or within Africa, you'll find places where there's plenty of food and places where there is not so much food. And the combination of circumstances that rules whether or not you live in a food desert or you don't have access to food, or whether you've got the power and the money to buy the food, is really highly context specific. So there isn't a simple answer to that.
You know, tell me why is there this problem? I'm going to speak idealistically and naively for a second. I know you're going to talk me out of my naivete, but I want you to do that for me. There's all these people. There's a demand for food. There's a market mechanism for meeting demand. Some people believe the market is like the most efficient meter of human demand in history. So all these hungry people, there's all this food, there's enough food. So why is there a problem in the first place about getting the supply to where the demand is? What prevents it from being just a nice Adam Smith type equilibrium thing?
I think the easiest way to ask that is to ask yourself the question, why in America is the poorest people's diet the most unhealthy? Because therein lies exactly the problem, that it's easy to get, well, as long as you've got some money, it's easy to get the basics of food. But to have enough food, the right sort of food for a healthy life, requires you to have quite a lot of money. And of course, the poorest people with the least amount of money, they don't necessarily command the market unless they're in enormous volumes. And so once you get to the developing world, where the market, if it exists, is very highly fragmented, there isn't economic power there to drive that nice, simple economics 101 type solution.
So, I mean, it seems to me the problem is that there's a difference between demand and need. I mean,
the
market is very good for meeting demand, but demand comes measured in dollars or pounds or, in the old days, euros. But need comes measured in calories, and I don't think our free enterprise people are always totally cognizant of the distinction.
Yeah, well, it's not just calories. It's calories and nutrition. It's very easy, certainly in our worlds, to get as many calories as you want from sugar and fat and, you know, fizzy drinks and all the rest of that. But to get enough nutrition to have a healthy life is typically something that costs more money. So that's why the poorest people tend to have access to diets that are not so good for them in the long term.
Yeah, we've got email from Tim. I don't think that's email from you. I think it's a different Tim. But he says, and he brings up Monsanto, one of the companies we like to kick around in these discussions. How about the morally bankrupt position of Monsanto, of engineering seeds that will not produce more seeds? Seems like an affront to nature to engineer the life reproducing aspects of food crops in order to control the food supply. Now I take it there's a debate here about whether technology, which means big companies, which means patents, are the route to food justice or the route away from food justice. What, as the food champion of a major country, what's your view?
I'm kind of officially agnostic on this front. Clearly, technology plays a role for a whole range of things, and we couldn't live our lives. Almost no one in the world could live their lives these days without technology. So technology in itself is not evil or not bad, but of course any technology can be used for purposes which are not morally justifiable in that way. But I would just put on the table that, you know, we live our lives and expect people to be rewarded for their intellectual property. But when that intellectual property is applied to maintaining your rights over food technology that's been developed, people do tend to have a different reaction than if it is over their latest phone or something like that. So I don't necessarily see that patenting food technology is necessarily bad any more than patenting any other parts of our lives.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about food justice. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And we've got a caller, William from Belvedere is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm particularly interested in the way in which political activity affects food security, and I'd like to give you this example. Take Syria. When people rose up in Syria, a group of people, against the Assad regime, there was many people who said, oh, we should be supporting the rebels because Assad is a dictator, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to tell you the whole thing. So perhaps with good intentions, it was decided that aid would be given to the rebels, et cetera, to those people who want to overthrow the government. And the next thing you know, you have 200,000 people become refugees and actually have to leave the country, leave their farms. There's a complete disruption of every aspect of society, and then you have real food insecurity. So I would appreciate some comment on how a philosopher looks at that interrelationship between political activity and food security.
Great question, William. I didn't know where you were going, and I love where you got to when you did get there. Great question. What do you think, Tim?
I would hesitate to call myself a philosopher, but I would say that access to food has been a very potent weapon throughout human history. And controlling access to food as a means of controlling the populace or conquering other populaces is something that we've lived with throughout our human history.
I think William's question, though, was getting at something like that, but something also the unintended consequences of many actions that we take. And one of the things we don't do, one of the things we didn't do for a long time is think about the consequences of our action on the global environment. Mm-hmm. You know, the Industrial Revolution, pell-mell growth and all that sort of stuff. Another thing we don't do, and I think, is think about the consequences of our actions on food security. I think people like you are bringing food security into the limelight, and like it's one of the big global issues, too, right up there with climate change, and maybe at some point, politicians, ordinary citizens like me and John and others will start thinking about the impact of our actions on global food security. Do you have any hope of that?
Absolutely. For me, that is the long-term direction of travel that we absolutely have to go on. So if you just think about climate change, water insecurity, we're losing soils, 25% of the world's soils are degraded, widespread biodiversity loss, etc. Intergenerational equity means that we have to preserve the environment so that future generations can grow food as well. And then that implies to me that we're not paying enough for food, because the costs of food are externalizing the environmental impacts. So, you know, you don't pay the climate costs of eating your steak or whatever. And so this makes the whole situation worse, because in a real world, the environmental costs of food that should be part of the food bill will just make food poverty and food insecurity even more complex to deal with. But at some stage, we have to do it, and governments are starting to recognize that.
To go back to William's questions, and maybe more from a personal point of view than a philosophical point of view, when I was a kid, we used to quote people that said, well, you know, Mussolini made the trains run on time. Hmm. The idea was kind of, well, dictators are pretty bad, but they do have their upside. I would say that if we say that getting food and clean water is a human right, along with freedom of speech and freedom of religion, then we're going to have to think about the relative merits of deposing dictators who do a very bad job with some human rights, like freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but do a pretty good job with getting the food distributed around to the people in their country. I mean, this is a very unphilosophical point of view, and it's kind of depressing. But I think we as a nation have underestimated the value of having a country that's at least, if the trains don't run on time, at least there's trains.
Well, I don't think it's unphilosophical, and I think there's a case in point. I think actually China has done a really good job, as I understand it, with, you might think of the China of Mao, where there was this massive famine, but contemporary China, there's not massive starvation or famine in China, is there, Tim?
No, China's in a relatively good situation, and their central planning and less reliance on the free market to deliver everything means that they are much more strategic in this matter than most developed world governments. And, you know, I think for the governments in the G20, other than China, there is an issue to think, well, what is going to happen if extreme weather disrupts our transport infrastructure? What's going to happen to our food security because we can't necessarily rely on it because we haven't done that strategic planning in the way that some countries have?
Let's put a philosophical conundrum in John's voice here. Suppose I was China and I said, I could go to greater democracy, greater market forces with more, but the consequence would be more food inequality, more food insecurity for more. Or I could stay with a more centrally planned, politically repressive form of government, but I get everybody having equal access or greater access to food and healthcare and all that sort of stuff. Now, how do I decide whether I should do that? Go the way of the unequal Western states and democracies, or go the way of the more repressive but more, in some ways, egalitarian? What do you think? I mean, that seems to be the question. A question.
Yeah, well, I think the kind of conventional mantra is that governments in the neoliberal economies should step in where there is market failure. And there is patently market failure when it comes to food insecurity issues, to do with the unsustainability of production, to do with a whole range of things that define this space. And so perhaps that's the call for greater regulation, not to turn every country into a dictatorship.
Yeah, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about food justice with Tim Benton from the University of Leeds.
What steps can we take to solve the global food crisis? Should we all stop eating beef and drinking coffee? Eggplant and orange juice? Can science and technology solve our problem somehow without having to give up steak?
How to achieve food justice for all when Philosophy Talk continues.
A hungry mob is an angry mob. No doubt true. We're thinking about food justice. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Tim Benton, professor of population ecology at the University of Leeds.
Tim, we've got an email from Lulu in San Francisco who says, the roving report covered fair trade, which definitely seems better than non-fair trade. Fair trade products. However, those people are still growing cash crops for export instead of using their resources to grow food for themselves. Is this right? And let me put this in the context of a larger challenge to you. We're going to promote you from being food champion for UK to being food czar for the entire world for some short period of time, maybe a week or a day. What changes would you make? What would you do about the question Lulu asks? How would you organize the world to promote food justice?
Wow.
Isn't that what champions
right.
do?
Yeah. Indeed. Okay, well, let me just bite off a little bit of Lulu's question first, and then I'll go on to some of the bigger things. I think the issue about fair trade or fairly traded produce is making sure that producers have enough income and are not cut through down to the bone by big ag or big retailers and all the rest of that. And in a sense, that's a form of ethical buying, income support, and who could argue with it? You could argue a little bit about whether fair trade or fairly traded is the way to go, but neither here nor there, I would say. The big question, what would I change? I would make sure that across the developing world, there was the infrastructure that allows people to connect to markets. So roads, simple things like that. If you are a small farmer and you have to bicycle your produce to market, then it is almost impossible for you to imagine any form of sensible income and economic growth. Then much more around the developing world, I would make sure that the full cost of the environment was incorporated into the food. So we did agriculture in a sustainable way. This would imply that food prices would increase, which would also help us reduce waste, perhaps have better nutrition. But in a world where food prices do go up, we have to ensure that there is income support or other means of feeding the poorest.
I thought you were going to say, I thought you had implied that in answer to the previous question. Economists talk about externalities. I buy some oil from you. I get the oil. You get my money. That transaction puts a cost on the environment. It pollutes. Neither of us pays the cost of polluting the environment. You get your profit. I get to drive around and pollute the air, and everybody else has to pay for the externalities I've imposed. It sounded to me like you think food transactions in the developed world, especially, have lots of externalities, and you want to internalize it. You want to internalize those externalities by driving up the price of food through something like taxation. I just want to make sure I got that implication right.
Not necessarily taxation, but I think we have to recognize that if by producing food you kill bees or biodiversity that's useful, or you erode the soils so no one else in future generations can grow food, or you put an awful lot of carbon into the atmosphere which stops other people growing food because of climate change, those are costs that leave problems for other people. So internalizing those costs either through the food chain and into the price of food, or internalizing those costs through a polluter pays principle, or paying those costs through general taxation, those costs do have to be paid.
Yeah.
And the issue is who does the paying?
And that would help solve this thing we started out talking about. I see that juicy steak on the shelf, and I think, I want to get that for me and my friends for a barbecue. I don't see the cost that my consumption of that steak imposes on the world, but the price, if it goes radically up through some of these kind of means, that does help me at least appreciate the cost. It may not make it visceral to me, but it makes me appreciate that cost.
And it might help you have a better, more nutritious diet as well. If the price reflected nutritional issues as well as environmental issues.
So Western nations like America and France and, you know, many countries in the European Union subsidize their farmers in various ways. Mm-hmm. In America, we subsidize the growing of corn, which has many deleterious health effects and makes and is very important to the beef industry. If you were a czar for a day, what restrictions would you put on governments being able to subsidize and distort the market in that sense with respect to what their farmers do?
Well, the official mantra is that all subsidies are distort the market and lead to all sorts of interesting negative consequences. With respect to our subsidy system, the European Union is moving towards paying the subsidy in terms of environmental goods that the farmers give, rather than paying a subsidy just for the farmer to farm. So in a sense, that's a payment for ecosystem service. We are paying farmers not to produce food, but to produce food and bees and clean water and good climate control and all the other things.
So I read a suggestion, or at least I think I watched it on a YouTube video, of a woman had a radical thought. Beef needs to go away, she said. Meat production, chickens and meat and beef need to go away.
Chickens?
Yeah, even chickens. They're not environmentally sustainable, the production of this on a massive scale. And she suggested that we should start getting their protein from insects, because insects can be fed on waste. You don't have to grow crops like corn and soybean to feed them, and their greenhouse emissions of the whole thing is minuscule compared to the production of bee. The only thing is there's kind of a yuck factor, and she said, we don't know if people ate insects on a massive scale how many allergies would be investigated, but she was proposing this as a radical but realistic solution to the world's food problem. What do you think about that? Eating more and more. She said, give up your Christmas turkey and have a Christmas insect pie.
Somehow I don't think we'll ever get around to doing that, but there is a utility in that. But I would also pose the question, most of us in the developed world overeat proteins by a factor of about 3. So why do we need to, if we're reducing meat, why do we need to put in another sort of protein? We can get plenty enough from just a standard diet with a little bit less meat in. Eating insects doesn't necessarily upset me in any more thought than eating prawns, for example, which are kind of like a marine insect.
Yeah. Well, actually, prawns and other bottom feeders have a much more disgusting.
Exactly.
I mean, if you look at the whole where their food comes from and what they do with it, lobsters and crabs and prawns. I mean, your average locust lives on vegetables.
But let me ask you a question. I want to go back to her. I can't remember the woman's name. I just remember the vivid characterization of this. But is she right that the environment, if we did switch to a insect based diet for our protein, that right there would solve and got rid of the whole beef and chicken industry and all that? That right there would solve a lot of the problem. Well, at least the environmental impact of the problem?
It would free up 4 billion people's worth of calories.
So are we really being a little unfair to chickens or overly fair to chickens here? I don't like torturing chickens, raising them in completely uncivilized ways. But I've always had the feeling that chickens are a good converter of vegetable stuff to protein.
Yeah.
They're not very bright, so maybe the moral problems aren't as big as with pork, who's very bright. Do chickens really need to go the way of beef in order to have food justice?
No, I don't think so. Chickens are almost an order of magnitude better in terms of more efficient than beef. But let me just throw a fact into the kind of the mix here. For an American eating an average amount of meat, the carbon emissions from eating the meat are about the same as driving 10,000 kilometers in a standard modern compact car.
Wow.
So we
that's for
forget,
a year, right?
Yeah, oh. But we forget that actually the environmental costs of our consumption decisions really do matter and really do make a difference.
So let me ask you another question about the environmental consumption cost of our consumption decisions. I want to know how intertwined the problem of global warming is with our food consumption. I mean, I think of automobiles and industry and all that sort of stuff, but you're making me believe that as large of a contributor to the problem of global warming is the global food system. Is that right or wrong?
The global food system, including land use conversion, is about 1.5 times what transport emits on a yearly basis. So it is a much bigger than cars and lorries and all the rest of that.
Wow. So what are we going to do about this? Come on, what are we going to do about this?
Well, this comes down to, who has the power in the food system? Is it government, is it consumers, or is it the retailers? And this is a really interesting middle ground. But ultimately, we have the food system that we want. If we as consumers didn't want to eat the stuff that retailers are putting on the shelves, they wouldn't put it on the shelves.
So that was, is there somebody who has a stake, as it were, in it being the way it is, and those people, because of their stake in the way it is, are completely resistant to change?
The power structure is huge in big business, as you, I'm sure you know. So just as an example, another study I came across recently, in the Netherlands, this is just where this study was done, 65,000 farmers, 17 million consumers, and there are 5 sourcing companies in the middle. So the power vested in the standard way of doing business is huge. They have an interest in changing, they have an interest in being more sustainable, but the ability to do so is really constraining.
So I'm gonna, I have time for one caller here. Make it brief. Eileen in Mountain View.
Oh, hi. What's the effect of using food crops or land that could be used to grow food crops on food security for people?
That's a good question. What's last comment, Tim?
So it is kind of crazy in any realistic sense. At the moment, only about 5% of global calories go into fuel crops. But, you know, if that were to grow, then it's a real competition. But you could also think of it as it's not a competition between fuel and food. It's a competition between fuel and feed for livestock. So, again, if we ate a little bit less meat, it would free up some land that could be sensibly used for biofuels.
Tim, this has been a great conversation. I feel like we've only scratched the surface, so I'd love to have you back sometime. But for now, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks very much. I very much enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Tim Benton. He's a professor of population ecology at the University of Leeds. And most importantly of all, he's the UK champion for global food security. So, John, are you hungry? What are you thinking now?
What am I thinking? Well, I'm thinking about lunch. But, I'm thinking about if we really replay the Rawls original position thing and take some of these things that maybe weren't too much in the forefront of his thinking, like the moral right to food and air and water. How does the conversation go? How do things change? Then my other thought is a more lighthearted one, Ken. Since it's been a sober conversation, I'll just say that as I go around the world, many airports now have food courts. And if we've got food courts, can food justice be far behind?
Oh, my God, John, that was awful. That was really awful. This is a complicated problem. I'd love to think more about China versus the West in solving these problems, you know. But this conversation will continue. It's already started at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community of thinkers. You can do so just by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
And now, a quick bite from a fast talker. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. When I was a kid, food was easy. Casserole on weekdays, a pot roast on weekends. If you went out, it wasn't to a fancy restaurant, but a steakhouse for a sirloin or maybe breaded shrimp. None of this French-fried snails and garlic nonsense. That was for book writers and actors. If we had to lose weight, we didn't have diets. We had Benzedrine and cigarettes, like God intended. The only vegetarians were insane hippie cult members who wasted away to nothing and died. Then we became better people who knew better. We now know that sugar is bad, fat is bad for you, meat is murder. All the land they use to graze beef or whatever they do with beef could be used better housing a tech startup, a football stadium, or a parking lot. But our knowing better also mutated. Just a few short years ago, it was upscale and hip to get your blueberries from Chile in the winter. It showed everybody that you were willing to spend serious money for good food. It was conspicuous consumption at its finest. If you served blueberries with Haagen-Dazs at your Oscar party, everybody assumed you had your fruit flown in from South America by jet. Blackened redfish was the rage du jour at fine dining establishments, remember? Became so popular, in fact, they were overfished, led to a ban on their commercial fishing in Louisiana. Of course, a lot of this indulgence was driven by drug use. The same impulses seem to be driving us today, only austerity and overwork are the new cocaine. We ride bicycles. We tweet on the smartphones and feel good about ourselves. We eat local and organic, or try to, and only eat meat or kale that we have killed ourselves, with special implements handcrafted in Berkeley by bearded hipsters named Jedediah and Jeb. Good for us, good for you, good for the planet. Self-righteousness easily trumps the snobbery of the gourmand. Gluttony will soon be a thing of the past. Food wastes time. There's even a product called, believe it or not, Soylent, named ironically for Soylent Green, which, if you remember your film history, was actually people. This Soylent is not people. It is a kind of protein smoothie you can ingest without leaving work. Absorb while coding the app that will disrupt the previous app you coded last week. Who has time to eat? We'll turn into startup astronauts subsisting entirely on Tang and tubes of peanut butter. In the meantime, food itself is being disrupted. Is there a way to eat beef, for instance, without the dead cow part? Scientists are working on that. Sergey Brin from Google funded a project in which beef was grown in vitro. Supposedly, after a year and $325,000, a whitish-gray patty was produced from stem cells. What does a $250,000-plus hamburger taste like? One witness said, animal protein cake. Yum. There's the 21st century in a virtual nutshell, really. Amazing and so what at exactly the same time. Which reminds me, I'm hungry. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topete, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm having spam, 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 baked beans, spam, spam, and spam.
Baked beans rule!
Well, can I have spam instead?